or the crystal labyrinth in sight. Bulvi could see two portals. They were both active, each a circle of iridescent energy. He recognized smoke-shrouded Tisker beyond the one on the right. Through the other was a long corridor, much like the crystal passage they had just left, though intact.
"You are destroying us all!"
came an unwelcome voice. He turned and saw Issachar Orr striding towards him.
"Your blundering weakens the fabric of the portalways,"
the sorcerer continued.
"These are delicately contrived creations. Stop for all our sakes!"
Bulvi took a step towards the son of Magnus, his pistol rising a fraction. The sorcerer lifted up empty hands as he walked.
"I am unarmed, as you can see."
Orr walked past Bulvi and several legionaries locked in hand-to-hand combat, until he stood between the two portals. He gestured to the one to Tisker, the image wavering like a visual feed losing its clarity.
"Attack me, and you'll never see the real universe again."
"The wolf and the dog do not play together. I do not bargain with the Emperor's enemies. You—"
Orr raised a dismissive hand.
"Oh, silence, you oaf. These portals are exceptionally fine-tuned. Each time you barge through one, you are upsetting a harmonious matrix of forces that took centuries to put into place. Each gateway needs to be calibrated, orientated, and verified before and after each translation. It is mostly luck that I was able to get us here to the stasis heart."
Bulvi glowered.
"What have you done with my warriors?"
"These wolves,"
the sorcerer replied, gesturing towards the frozen scene of battle.
"They are in temporal paralysis. Momentarily, I will release them, along with my own brothers. We will call a ceasefire, you and I. I will surrender to your custody, and then we will all return to Tisker and escape this awful mess that you have created."
"What of the others? The ones lost in the maze?"
Letting his gaze fall, Orr hesitated.
I cannot vouch for their continued survival. What they have done threatens the fabric of Prospero itself, and other worlds besides. The labyrinth will purge them eventually, when we have restored some semblance of control."
"Purge them?"
Orr nodded.
"Like an organism expunging a foreign body,"
he said, trying to remove any trace of emotion from the words. Still wary, the old wolf grunted. He considered that prospect for a moment, then straightened.
"You willingly surrender?"
"It seems to be the only way that any of us will get back to Prospero alive."
Bulvi grunted again, then cocked his plasma pistol.
"No. The Wolf King was very clear. I cannot accept your surrender."
He fired. The plasma blast ripped open Orr's chest, flinging broken warplate and charred flesh. Like a pressure seal bursting, time reasserted itself. With a thunderclap shock, the turmoil and clamour of battle engulfed Bulvi. Bolts and missiles screamed past, the snarls of the space wolves and battle cries of the thousand suns filling the immense chamber. The old wolf spun towards the Tisker portal. Silvered spires were still plainly visible through the arch. With a wolf lord suddenly in their midst, the thousand suns were thrown into disarray, and Bulvi hewed the legs from under a retreating traitor. A ragged whisper drew his attention to where Issachar Orr crawled closer.
"Fool! You have doomed us all!
My brothers are still lost, and yours at large. We will not rest until all have been found."
Orr summoned enough strength to spit blood at Bulvi's feet.
"Error carries away the unteachable."
The old wolf smiled cruelly, readying his axe.
"A gift should be repaid in kind," he growled.
He split the sorcerer's skull, and the Tisker portal flickered and died with him. Bulvi saw that the other was still open, heading back into the cosmic labyrinth. Several of the thousand suns withdrew through the shimmering veil, disappearing from view. He charged, plasma pistol spitting ruin, Eldingvafal making a bloody cleft of another foe's head. Bulvi's war cry echoed as he leapt towards the open portal.
"Did you destroy our way home, old wolf?"
Jürgen called out, stepping over the body of a fallen son of Magnus, his blade wet and red.
Are we to head further into the nightmare labyrinth of the half-warp forever?
Bulvi roared with laughter.
We were not born for easy deaths, my wolf brothers, he replied. Into the maze, wherever it leads, and spare none the blade of retribution.
That was The 13th Wolf by Gav Thorpe, read by Jonathan Keane. Into Exile by Aaron Dembski Bowden, read by Jonathan Keeble. Ten. Gritty ochre dust clings to the dead warrior's open eyes. A shadow retreats from his still form. Something immense, yet hunched. Something with rattling joints and grinding metal claws. It strides away, limping badly, its orders unfulfilled, its masters informed. The legionary lies in the dirt, his duty done. Nine. The scholar sits hunched in the chamber of stinking steel and bleeding bodies, breathing in the scorched scents of mangled automata and riven human flesh. The creature on his shoulder bears no small resemblance to a species of simian, detailed in the archives of ancient Terra. Its name is Sapien. The scholar named it himself when he constructed the creature from vat-cloned fur and consecrated metals. The cyber monkey gives a worried chitter at their surroundings. The scholar feels no such unease. Only disgusted irritation. He sneers at these charnel house surroundings, this place of the ruined and the wounded that is supposedly his salvation. The arched walls shake around him. Outside the ascending ship, the sky of sacred Mars is on fire. Far below, Nicanor will be dead by now. Butchered, no less. The fool. Arkanland huddles like some filthy refugee amidst the other survivors, praying to the Omnissiah that the reek of their cowardice and failure won't infect him. Sapien scampers to Land's other shoulder. He chitters again, the tone wordless yet curiously inquisitive.
He was a fool, the scholar murmurs,
idly stroking the cog-like vertebrae plates that made up the little creature's spine.
Space Marines! He snorts the word. They're all fools.
But even to himself, those words ring a little hollow this time. Eight. Nicanor stares into his slayer's eyes. His own blood marks the bulbous golden domes of the war machine's visual actuators, blood that he coughed into the thing's face right after it drove the crackling motorized spear through his breastplate. It keeps him aloft, impaled, his boots scarcely scraping the dust that makes up the useless yet priceless Martian soil. Each scuff smears away the red-brown regolith to reveal greyer earth beneath, a secret of the red planet concealed mere inches beneath the surface, yet unknown to most capable of conjuring the world's image in their imaginations. The machine leans in closer. The domes of its insect eyes inspecting the prey, recording Nicanor's face and the markings upon his armour. The dying warrior hears the clicking whir of an open transmission sluice as his killer exloads its findings to its distant masters. This is prey. It knows that in the processes of its murderously simple consciousness. But this is the wrong prey. Nicanor swallows the pain. He doesn't cower from it, and he refuses to let it consume him. Pain is felt only by the living, and thus it is nothing to regret. Pain is life, Pain can be overcome as long as breath resides in the human and transhuman body. He will die, he knows this, but he will not die ashamed. Honour is everything. Blood falls from Nicanor's clenched teeth as the war machine shakes him, seeking to dislodge him from the toothed length of its spear limb. The lance is buried too deeply in his innards, clutched by reinforced bone and armour plate, and refusing to easily come free. He feels his left boot connect with his fallen bolt gun, the ceramite clanking against the gun's kill-marked metal body. Even if he could twist to reach for it without tearing himself in two, the weapon is empty. Through his reddened gaze, he still sees the scorched pockmarks cratering the robot's head, where every bolt he fired found its target. The war machine lowers its spear, slamming the impaled warrior hard against the dusty ground, and its taloned foot crunches down on Nicanor's limp form for leverage. With a brace and a wrench of machinery joints, the lance tears free in a fresh scattershot of bloody ceramite and cooling gore. The disemboweling also pulls the last breath from what remains of Nicanor's body. He stares up, strengthless and silent, and he sees nothing in the robot's implacable eye-domes. There is no hint of intelligence or sign of who might be watching through the automaton's retinal feed. His greying gaze slides skyward, slipping from the hunched and bolt-blasted carapace of his mechanical slayer. There, rising into the embattled sky, is the silhouette of the scholar's transport vessel. It would be poetic to say that this is Nicanor's final thought, and victory is his final sight. Neither is true. His final thought is of the ruination of his breastplate, where the symbol of the Raptor Imperialis had shone so proud in ivory upon the golden yellow plate. His last sight is of Mondus Oculum, where subterranean foundries and bolt-shell manufactories burn beneath the Martian rock, and where the last of his brother's gunships stream into the sky. The dust in the air begins to settle over his armour, upon his torn body, even on his eyes as they twitch one last time, yet fail to close. The war machine casts a shadow across his corpse as it records his demise. 7. Land runs, breath soaring from his mouth, spit spraying with each heave. His boots clang up the gang ramp, which rises already beneath his panicked tread. He doesn't look back, not to bid the Space Marine farewell, not to bear witness to the warrior's final moments. The hammer crash of Nicanor's discharging bolt gun is the last thing that Land hears before the hatch grinds inexorably closed. There, in the fresh dark, he collapses to his hands and knees, all dignity abandoned. Shaking hands drag the multi-lens focusing goggles from his face. Safe, he thinks. Safe. And for some reason the thought feels almost treasonous. Perhaps a lesser man might consider it guilt. The niggle of a weak soul's conscience, knowing that Nicanor is still out there, selling his life to buy Land's survival. But pragmatism drowns any pathetic stirring of morality. Conscience and guilt are concepts brought into being by those too meek to face up to their failures, seeking to mark their hesitations as virtues. He has to survive. That's the beginning and end of it. He matters infinitely more than a single legionary. Nicanor's own actions prove the truth of it. Ascension, comes a servitor's bland tones over the chamber-wide vox. The transport begins its rise in shaking inelegance. Arkan Land weaves through a compressed sea of moaning, wounded forms, and sits with his back to the chamber wall. Sapien squawks an entirely unsimian sound as he takes his place upon his master's shoulder. 6.
Run!
Nicanor's voice, even weakened, is a roar above the wind.
Run, damn you!
He turns with his bolt gun braced against his shoulder, trusting that the techno-archaeologist's arrogance and fear will serve even if Nicanor's command fails. The war machine lopes and lurches closer, leaping over the wind-smoothed grey rocks that lie across the Martian surface like the tumble-down shamanic stone circles of old Earth. And it is the same machine. It bears the scars that Nicanor already inflicted upon its armor-plating with bolter and bomb back in the Mesatan complex. It sprints forwards on backward-jointed legs, its chain-toothed limbs revving in the silence of its empty rotor cannons. Nicanor's bolt gun barks in futility. Explosive shells strike true, detonating against the stalker killer's insectoid cranial housing, doing little more than jerking the head with its bulbous golden eyes to the side. He knows he can't kill it. He knows he doesn't need to. Sigismund didn't send him here to kill this thing. He drops the bolter the instant his retinal display chimes that his magazine is empty. His power sword flares to life in both hands before the gun has even hit the ground. The hunting machine could circle around him if its cognitive processes choose to do so, but threat sensors flicker with suggestions of caution. This prey has thwarted it once already, and time is short. The kill must be now, or it will be never. It charges, janky legs clanking, spear-limb joints bunch up, driving back into their piston housings. It leaps, emitting a scrap-code shriek for want of a true battle-cry. Nicanor hurls himself to the side, rolling in the dust and dirt, defacing his damaged armor further by occluding the proud symbols that have stood upon the ceramite for over 3 decades. His injuries leave him slow, slower than he has ever been. He comes to his knees in a sense-lost haze of disorientation, thrusting upwards with the blade. It bites. It bites deep, with the snarling kiss of an aggravated power field knifing into sensitive mechanics. Sparks fly in place of blood spray. He feels the machine buckle above him, its thwarted core straining, the sword buried in the underside of its hip joint, threatening to plunge the beast machine to the ground.
"He must live," Nicanor thinks, tasting blood in his mouth. "And he will."
He pulls the blade free from the crippled war machine in exalted silence, stoic to the last, leaving the bellowing of war shouts for the warriors of lesser legions that require such pageantry. The sword snaps near the hilt as the machine whines and staggers back. Nicanor is rising, turning, just in time for the stalker killer's primary limb to emit a peal of crunching thunder as it pounds through the Space Marine's plastron. It shatters the reinforced casing of his fused ribs, kills the motive force of his Mark II battle armor as it lances through the suit's back-mounted power pack. It annihilates both of his hearts, 2 of his 3 lungs, the progenoid gland in his chest. He coughs blood as the crippled machine drags him up before its alien face. He is grinning when he hears the engine cacophony from the transport lifting off.
"He lives," he tells his killer.
These will be his last words.
"You have failed."
5. They are almost to the landing site when Arkan Land realizes the severity of the Space Marine's wounds. The warrior's limp becomes a stagger, his stride arrested as he seeks to pull his helmet clear and breathe without the filtration grill. It comes free to reveal a dark face with a typical Terran equatorial skin shade, blood riming the gritted teeth. It is the first time Land has seen the warrior's features. He makes no comment on this, because he doesn't care. Since emerging from the underground complex, there has been no sign of their pursuer. Ahead, across the rusty desert, the orbital lander sits with its gang ramps down, accepting evacuees and materiel in a shuffling and stumbling trickle. It is not the ship that Land would have chosen for himself, nor would he associate with the scavengers and dregs now boarding it, had he any other choice. But it is said that beggars cannot be choosers. The same can be said for refugees. Without even realizing he is doing it, Land shields Sapien from the gathering wind, holding the cyber monkey in the folds of his magisterial crimson robe. Sapien accepts this treatment, displaying a fanged maw no natural simian had ever possessed. The expression may possibly be a smile.
"A space marine,"
Land calls over the wind.
"All is well,"
the towering warrior calls back. Plainly, it is a lie. all is anything but well. Nicanor touches a gauntleted hand to the shattered ceramite at his side. The armoured fingers come away red.
"Your kind do not bleed this much," Land accuses him with lazy vehemence. "I have read the physiological data myself in detail."
"We bleed this much," the Imperial Fist replies, "when we are dying."
He gestures to the segmented evacuation craft being slowly abraded by the rising wind.
"Keep moving, techno-archaeologist Land."
But Land doesn't keep moving. He fixes his multi-lens goggles over his eyes, looking back the way they came. Not for the first time, he wishes he was armed. His collection of antiquities boasts many archaeotech weapons, the pinnacle of his hoard being a deliciously beautiful sidearm with humming aural dampeners, rotating magnetic vanes, and the capacity to fire microatomic rounds. But it, along with many of his possessions, is elsewhere. A significant portion of his priceless finds are safely secured and await him once he reaches the ring of iron that surrounds Mars in a sacred dockyard halo. Even so, he is already cataloguing the innumerable precious items he has been forced to abandon on the planet today. Evacuation is such a dirty word. Sapien hisses in his cradle of robes. Land nods, as if the sound holds some kind of sense, adjusting his goggles' visual range with a clicking twist of a side dial.
"A space marine,"
he says, looking over the dusty plain behind them.
"Something is approaching from the southern ridge."
It has followed them through the complex, after all. All of those Byzantine twists and turns, hoping to put distance between themselves and their foe, have been nothing more than wasted meandering. The wounded warrior clutches his weapons tighter as he turns. Land hears the click of Nicanor's eye lenses resetting, cancelling their zoomed view.
"This ends now," Land thinks. "One way or another, this ends now."
"Get to the ship," the Space Marine says.
And when Land moves at a slow, exhausted jog instead of a sprint, Nicanor's temper finally flares.
"Run!"
he says, his voice a crack of breaking Arctic ice.
"Run, damn you!"
4. They walk through tunnels of flickering light, the power systems feeding the Mesotan complex failing one by one, falling to abandonment or treachery. Their passage is sung in the sound of their footsteps, the techno-archaeologist's ragged, tired tread, and the Fist's own fading gait. Nicanor no longer disguises his limp. Fluid leaks from where the robot's withering storm of solid slug gunfire savaged his armour plating. It's worst in several medial and inferolateral locations that he doesn't need his retinal display to describe. He can feel the grind of abused metal against, and inside, injured flesh, without the aggressive chime of warnings across his visor display. He can smell his own wounds, smell their coppery openness from a refusal to heal with the expected speed. That isn't a good sign.
"You said there was a ship,"
Arkanland says, without looking back at the warrior.
"A suborbital,"
Nicanor confirms.
"Already it sounds like some grotesque last gasp for refugees."
That is exactly what it is, Nicanor thinks.
"The arrangements were made with whatever resources were available."
"Arranged by whom?"
the techno-archaeologist, a wheezing shape of rippling crimson robes, radiates an aura of disapproval.
"By you?"
"First Captain Sigismund,"
Nicanor replies.
"And fabricator locum Zagreus Kane."
Still he doesn't turn, yet Nicanor hears the smirk in Land's tone.
"Fabricator General Zagreus Kane now, I'll wager. Omnisire, preserve us from that punishingly dull creature in his limited vision."
Nicanor casts back a sweat-stinging gaze into the flickering depths of the corridor behind. He sees nothing. No new warning chimes pulse on his retinal feed, beyond the one screaming of his injuries. His Auspex scanner remains silent. Corridor by corridor, they rise through the complex. Nicanor feels his limbs growing leaden as his body assimilates the adrenal sting of the Medicaid narcotics flooding his system. The strength they granted over the last hours deserts him by increments, inviting back the weary burn of his wounds. "I've never encountered one of those automata before," Nicanor says. Arkan Land turns his sharp features back upon his armored companion. Amusement gleams in the scholar's half-lidded eyes.
"A space marine with a passion for idle chatter. My, my, my. The surprises never cease."
Nicanor bridles.
"I seek answers, not conversation."
Land gives an unpleasant smile before turning to the tunnel ahead. The cyber monkey on his shoulder noisily crunches on a steel ingot.
"It is a Vorax,"
the techno-archaeologist says in an arch tone.
"This one has been modified by a forge noble to suit his or her own purposes, I've no doubt. But the chassis is that of a Vorax automaton. They rarely see use in the hosts of the Great Crusade any more. We release them into the forge cities when overpopulation becomes a concern. They are,"
he adds with a refined air,
"occasionally tasked for assassination protocols, but only against targets of sufficiently high priority."
Nicanor reads the pride in the scholar's voice. The man's arrogance knows no bounds.
"Who would want you dead, techno-archaeologist Land? The men and women you were keen to remain and face alone?"
The robed man scratches his hairless crown. For no reason Nicanor can discern, the cyber monkey mimics the gesture, scratching its own head.
"There you've asked a question of staggering ignorance, Space Marine. A great many of my contemporaries would enjoy the notion of me breathing my last. Not all, of course, but enough. On both sides of this new war."
Nicanor grunts at the pain in his side. Land takes it as a question.
"And why, you ask?"
The techno-archaeologist carries on, though Nicanor has asked no such thing.
"Because I am Arkan Land. Jealousy motivates them. Jealousy forged in their own insecurities. I suspect that says it all."
The Imperial Fist says nothing. He's seen unmodified humans do this before, the propensity that even overconfident souls have for fear babble in times of duress. When they emerge at last into the dubious light of the Martian dawn, the Z-Tech alkali plains stretch out before them. Nicanor gestures to a rise in the landscape.
"The ship waits over that ridge."
3. It's difficult not to be insulted, really. A single space marine? The Mesotan complex unlocks and unfolds before them via a series of grinding, whirring doors, resembling void-sealed bulkheads, a design choice that Arkan Land attributes to radiation shielding and disaster containment, rather than a consideration of security. Given what's happening across Mars, the insanity so poorly draped in the rags of revolution, he's unsurprised that the complex has been automatically locked down.
"We are being followed,"
the Space Marine says at one point. Land, who has heard nothing at all, gives a tired grunt. The pace is punishing. He has no augmentations. His throat is raw. His legs are burning. The techno-archaeologist and his companion move swiftly, their boots striking echoes through the empty colonnades. It's a disappointment, to be sure. Despite using the deserted complex as nothing more than a subterranean avenue for the sake of convenience, Land can't help but feel an irritated melancholy at what he's seeing. The emptiness reminds him of the underground mantle cities he so keenly explores, where his only companions in the search for knowledge are the dungeon-slaved defense systems of a forgotten age and the serenity of his own thoughts. Will you ever know that peace again? And how long will the power last here in Mesotan? Without the complex's thrall workers, the air filtration gargoyles mounted within each chamber will cease to breathe sooner rather than later. Anyone still down here within a few days will likely expire from asphyxiation. And this, Land reflects, would be a truly pointless place to die. On the run from his own contemporaries, no less. Omnis, sire, have mercy. It's almost maddening enough to be amusing. The Imperial Fist leads the way across a bridge stretching over a storage repository, where thousands of crates and containers make up a township below. A single space marine. Land draws breath to ask why the Imperial Fist is alone, why it was deemed appropriate for a mere lone warrior to defend and escort him, when their pursuer makes itself known. The Vorax strikes when they're halfway across the span, with nowhere to go. It's nasty and near feral cognition, aware that they can hardly leap from the high bridge to safety. The first sign of its presence is when the walkway judders on its support beams, and both Land and the Fist break into a run. Land's frantic stride takes him forward in flight. Not for a deluded second does he believe that the machine is here to save him, and the legionary immediately turns back the way they came. The Imperial Fist is a blur of grinding armour as he passes Land, while the techno-archaeologist is a flapping silhouette of austere robes and simian howling, the latter from Sapien rather than Land himself. Even as he's fleeing for his life, Land feels a tickle of embarrassed dread for believing that they had lost their pursuer for good.
"Get behind me!" the Fist demands.
Land obeys without thinking. The Vorax leans into its awkwardly graceful sprint, its bulbous sensoria domes locked in a cold animal glare. Its rotor cannons cycle to life, spear limbs retracting in something akin to bestial eagerness, ready to launch forth. The Imperial Fist stands between Land and the automaton. The Space Marine fires first. Land has never seen the Legionis Astartes fight before. Not outside of visual recordings, with his own eyes. Despite all the ways in which his work has aided, revolutionized, may not be too strong a word, really, the armories of the legions, the warriors themselves and their various capabilities have never particularly interested him, beyond the extent of the Omnisire's genius in creating them. He studied their physiology, insofar as he was able, but a great deal of it was sealed away behind Imperial Edict, and much of what he could access was bland propaganda. He left it at that. Frankly, he didn't care. War, to Arkan Land, has always been a notion of excruciating boredom. Land's passion is for how the rediscovered secrets of the past may brighten the future, rather than the tedious brutalities of the present. Space Marines are tools, and they fulfill their role with uninspired aplomb. This one is nevertheless an impressive specimen of the battling art. He opens up with a tremendous crash of bolter fire, every shot impacting against the Vorax's armor plating, not a single shell going wide. All the while he backs away, keeping his bulk between the machine and its kill target, twitching and buckling under the rattling slug fire from its rotor cannons and yet refusing to fall. Sparks fly from the Imperial Fist's armour. Scraps of ceramite clatter in steaming shards to the walkway gantry. He's being drilled. No other words sum up the destruction inflicted upon the towering warrior. He is being drilled by gunfire. Bullets whine and buzz past where Land cowers in the warrior's shadow. They spank and clang off the walkway's railings, inches from where he stands. Still, the bolt gun booms.
"Nicanor!"
Land says. It is the first and last time he will speak the Imperial Fist's name. Nicanor fires one-handed, grunting as his blood mists in the air. His free gauntlet reaches for the melter bomb bound to his back.
"Run!"
the Space Marine orders, and pulls the device.
"That will not... for the bridge!"
Nicanor keeps his armored pauldron facing the advancing reloading foe, with his helmet half-masked behind it.
"Not for the machine! Run!"
"He's going to blow the Land runs. 2. "You are the techno-archaeologist Arkan Land?" says Nicanor. It isn't a question. The man he addresses is slight of build, sparse of hair, wears multi-lens, wide-spectrum visualizer goggles lifted high up on his forehead, is clad in the layered robes of a senior adept over the more practical travelling bodysuit and rugged armour of a mendicant Martian, and is in the company of an artificimian, a cyber-monkey, that watches Nicanor with clicking picta eyes. Additionally, the man's facial features exactly resemble the image files that Nicanor has stored in his retinal display. This is unquestionably Arkan Land. Nicanor can see that the man is afraid, betrayed by an accelerated heart rate and the sheen of fear sweat on his brow. But there is pride here. Arkenland may be a non-combatant, and in fear for his life, and indeed his entire way of life, but he stands tall and defiant, even with a tremble in his limbs. This is good, Nicanor thinks in his dispassionately amused way. It is good to admire someone that you may have to die for.
I am he, the sharp-eyed human replies. And dare I ask which side you are on, Space Marine?
Nicanor stiffens at the insult of the man's words, though, given the circumstances, they are understandable enough.
I am Sergeant Nicanor Tullis of the Seventh Legion.
Bland sneers, rejecting the answer.
That tells me nothing but your name and your lineage, Space Marine.
I am loyal to the Emperor. At that, the techno-archaeologist exhales something between a sigh of relief and a breath of irritation.
I trust you are here to save me, then? Well, I commend you for your efforts in locating me, but those efforts have been in vain. I am not leaving my homeworld. Sacred Mars is aflame with heathenism, true enough, but it is my home.
Nicanor expected this. He commits precious seconds, looking around the laboratory, seeking any sign of weaponry capable of causing him harm. There appears to be precious little in the way of threat amongst the near preternatural degrees of clutter. Arkenland is hailed as a genius, but if his mind is as disordered as the space he inhabits, then it is a chaotic genius indeed that resides behind those unhappy features.
My brethren are assisting in the defense and evacuation of the Mondus Oculum Forge. I was assigned...
Land barks a laugh, speaking over Nicanor's declaration.
Oh, noble legionaries, come to save their precious armor foundries and plunder what they can before leaving the Forge World Principle to burn, eh?
I refuse to argue with you, techno-archaeologist Land.
A ship waits, hidden on the Z-Tech tundra. Stealth and caution are advised, and thus you will take no skimmer craft. You will make your way to Z-Tech via the Metasan Gearworks Complex, and you will board the transport. From there you will be taken to the Ring of Iron, and onward to Terra.
Land bares his teeth. It isn't a smile this time, not even a mocking one.
I cannot leave my work unattended, Space Marine.
The cyber monkey hangs from a series of bars set across the laboratory ceiling. They seem specifically constructed for the purpose. As the warrior and the scholar talk, the Artificimian swings its way across the room and drops to land on its master's shoulder.
If you remain here, Nicanor says, there is a chance you will be executed by the foe. Assassins may already be on their way.
The Omnisire will protect me,
Land replies piously and sincerely, making the sign of the cog with his linked knuckles.
The Emperor's own regent sent my legion here, Arkenland. Perhaps we are the protection you speak of and pray for.
Meta-spiritual philosophizing from a ceramite-clad brute? As if the rebellion raging across the world wasn't enough of a surprise for one lifetime. No, you Terran bastard, I'm not leaving.
Impassive to the man's resistance, Nicanor tries one last time. There is also a significant chance that if you are not executed by the Fabricator General's traitorous forces, you will be captured by them. Something, some emotion that Nicanor is incapable of reading, flashes in the scholar's eyes.
It is a direct possibility, he agrees.
And you understand, the warrior presses on with inhuman calm, that such an event cannot be allowed to transpire?
Ha!
Land snorts in simple disgust.
I know too much, eh? Can't risk me defecting. Is that it?
Nicanor says nothing. He draws his bolt gun and levels it at Arkenland's head. 1.
He must live, says Sigismund.
Nicanor listens to the words, words that are really an order. His raised face, and the face of every warrior present, is bathed in the flickering light of the tactical hololith. The images revolve through the air above the projection table, locked in a slow ballet of rotating illumination. They will make planetfall in an hour. They already know everything there is to know. All that remains is to allocate landing zones, to choose which warriors will go where. One side of the briefing display is given over to data relating to Arkan Land. The Arkan Land. The explorer and scholar responsible for so many expeditions into the ancient data crypts of Mars's crust and mantle. The man that brought back the beginnings of an anti-grav technology to the nascent Imperium. The man responsible for unearthing and sharing the schematics that led to the mass production of the raiders and speeders now seen in their thousands among the legions. Land raiders. Land speeders. The war machines are even named for him now. The stern, cold-eyed gaze of the Legion's first captain falls upon Nicanor. He feels Sigismund's stare before he sees it, and when he meets his marshal's eyes, he can do nothing but nod.
"He must live," Sigismund repeats.
Nicanor nods once. "And he will." That was Into Exile by Aaron Dembski-Bowden, read by Jonathan Keeble. Cybernetica by Rob Sanders, read by Jonathan Keeble. Mars. Mars, the red planet, an industrial powerhouse on a planetary scale, the nexus of all human knowledge and achievement in the galaxy. Home, for a time. That was Mars. The Mars of before. Analyze, interpret.
Limbs scything. Metallic chitin clashing, mandibles gnashing, the enemy swarming, legs, limbs, metal maws, the killing fields of Farinatus, the Xenos horror called the Brig Shea, everywhere.
As the creeping shadows of a dying day fell, the Raven Guard had slipped in through the sanctuary nests. Weighed down with breacher charges and detonators, they had achieved the impossible. 5 legionaries at one with the darkness and dread. The sons of Korax had zeroed in on their objective with transhuman patience and daring, moving through the nest from blister to blister. Their power-armored steps were as faint whispers through the alien architecture, passing things that twitched with antennae and red vibrations through the segmented lancets of their stabbing legs, all thinking as one with shell-armored brains. With their genetic gift for stealth and trademark imperturbation, the Space Marines had worked their way to the chittering heart of the swarm. But something had betrayed them. The crunch of grit beneath an armored boot, the scrape of a shield, a split-second slip of shadow, the reek of impending extermination. With one unknowable mistake, stealth and speed became swarming and slaughter. Sudden, shocking, sickening. The Xenos throng descended upon the legionaries with the force of a natural disaster, overwhelming and heedless. They knew nothing of the Emperor of Mankind, of planetary compliance, or the Great Crusade. All they knew was that a threat had been detected in the sanctuary nests, and that the threat had to be eliminated with all the unfeeling prejudice that their cold, verminous minds could process. The horror was over almost before it had begun. Urgent, yet impersonal. Cold, yet savage. Metal shells clashed like ancient plate, drowning out the brief thunder of gunfire. The legionaries pushed the monstrosities back with their boarding pavises. They drilled the vanguard creatures with rounds from bolters nestled in their shield muzzle rests, but the alien plague was persistent. As empty bolt guns clattered to the floor with battered shields, the thud of fire was replaced by the shrill chug of chainswords and the screech of monomolecular teeth through metallic chitin. It was an excruciating noise. The Raven Guard created a nimbus of swift death about them, with severed alien appendages dancing through the air, and whiplashes of ichor splattering the ground like unrefined oil. Skill and determination could not stand long against the impossible number of the Xenos swarm. Smaller specimens leapt through the busy swordwork and slaughter, scuttling up power-armored limbs to champ and chew horribly with immature mandibles. The stiletto legs of the mature creatures skewered and pinned the legionaries. Digital blades thrashed forth, slicing, slashing, and stabbing. The Raven Guard came apart in the furious, relentless horror of the Xenos attack. Black-armored forms slipped and slid about in pools of their own blood, kicking and reaching out with limbs that were no longer their own. Their world became a blur of chitinous frenzy, the hot jag of alien appendages plunging down through their armor, carapaces, and muscular torsos. Travian Clade was dreaming. He knew this only after the fact. It was an unusual event for the legionary. He had not dreamed since the killing fields of Farinatus, the very place where he had been mauled in the Xenos carnage of the Breg Shea, where he had lost both his legs and an arm to the alien swarm. On the Medicaid slab, Techmarine Rinkus and the Legion Apothecaries had taken away his pain. They had replaced phantom limbs with working wonders of plasteel and adamantium, appendage enhancements fit to serve the Space Marine, and in doing so serve the Emperor once more. Nostromon slurs and savage humor aside, he gained a new name from their compliance partners, the Night Lords, who had found what was left of him, and the name had stuck. The Carrion. In a Sergio sarcophagus, the young battle brother had learned the calm, disassociated horror of having been flesh and only flesh. The deadliest of enemies made the best teachers. The Carrion knew this. He relearned the lessons the Xenos abomination had taught him on Farinatus Maximus every time he had closed his eyes, a trauma of both body and mind that wormed its way through his psycho-indoctrination and training, a catalepsian nightmare from which he never truly awoke, a kind of unspeakable fear, not of the enemy, not of death, but of failure. The failure of flesh to achieve the unachievable and do what could not be done. Sergeant Travian Clade, hopeful, optimistic, and a most loyal servant of his Primarch, might have volunteered for the perilous mission and led the Breacher siege squad into the alien nest. But a dead man had returned, devoid of venture and spark. Gone was his enthusiasm for duty and martial delight in his physical capabilities. He did not need to look through the eyes of his legionary brothers to see that he was half what he had been, and half some monstrous wonder of metal and piston. He returned to his ranks a pale-faced ghost, a shadow of his former self. The Night Lords joked that Travian Clade was more carrion bird than raven now, a scavenger of parts. The name even found currency among his own ranks, where with great respect and very little admiration his own battle brothers dubbed him the Carrion, in honour of his agonizing one-armed crawl back through the sanctuary nests to the Night Lord's lines. Beyond the other cybernetic modifications, the servants of the Omnissiah had judged his salvaged flesh worthy, and had blessed him with oblivion. Concerned at the state of his recovery, Commander Alcanor had consulted the Techmarine Rinkus over how they might further help their patient. Rinkus settled on further surgery and augmentation. By that point, the Carrion cared little what happened to the remainder of his failed flesh. The incorporation of an autonomic shaft, driven like a cogitator spike through his brain, returned to the Space Marine some tranquility of mind. With supplementary sessions of psycho-indoctrination, it all but banished the living nightmare of his survival, driving the horror of the Xenos butchery on Farinatus to the back of his mind. Day by day, as his wounded mind and ruined body began to heal, the Carrion allowed himself to believe that he might once again be useful to his legion.
The presence of the cogitator spike was why the dream, any dream, was such an unusual occurrence. The integrated hardware that was now one with his brain had long since deemed such neural activity to be superfluous to function, and consigned it to a redundant meme cell. Getting up from his slab and standing in the meagre Martian sunlight that slipped in through the shutters of his preceptory cell, the Carrion willed himself to remember, to claw back the fading fantasy. He had not only dreamed of Farinatus and the horror of compliance, but also of the Red Planet, of magnificent Mars. It had seemed almost inevitable that the Carrion would go to Mars. Whether it was his personal experience of being one with the machine god, or the changing perspectives of his own legionary brothers, he knew he was no longer a streamlined secret, striking from the shadows. The 19th Legion fought with speed, stealth, and cunning. The Carrion, on the other hand, appeared to have been truly forged in battle. To his brothers, the wondrous workings of his interfaced limbs were clunky replacements, the very antithesis of their battle methodology. Before long, the suggestion had come from his commander that perhaps his talents would find better service among the ranks covenant of the Legion Techmarines. The Carrion was not aware that he had any such talents, but soon he found himself on the long journey back to the solar system, to Mars. There he was to find service to the Emperor in a new calling, sharing a tower preceptory with space marines from other legions, who had also come to learn from the Martian Mechanicum how best to serve their brothers through cult knowledge, observance, and technical skill. The dream was but a ghostly afterthought now. The memories of Mars were an echo fading beyond the searing nightmare of the battlefield horrors relived, but with an irony lost on the Carrion. The very cogitator systems that had buried the neural capture calculated a 72.365% chance that it had been catalogued in the redundant meme cell. From there, he accessed it, and relived what his systems had deemed best forgotten. Vacuity pending. Flesh ports open for data shunt. Meme stream ready for transference. Limbic tampion flushed. Confluence, interface, neurosynapses complete. Recollection commencing. In the main, it was a memory. A recorded remembrance, 30 years old, of his first day on Martian soil. The day he and the Iron Warrior Aulus Scaramanca had been assigned as Tech Marines in training to their mentor, Gnaeus Archelon, the great illuminant and artisan Astartes. The day the staid Archelon had shown them the dungeon diagnoplex of the Lexorcist General, and impressed upon the legionaries right from the very start the blasphemy of unsanctioned innovation, the lure of experimentation and perils of forbidden technology. The day he had seen the heretic, Octal Bool, consigned to eternity with his abominable creations in the stasis tombs of Promethei Sinus. The Tech Marine in training felt the experience flood back. The grandeur of the greatest forge world in the galaxy, forgotten in the subterranean doom of the Prefecture Magisterium Dungeon Diagnoplex.
Octal Bool, Majus Dominus of the Deiderii Reserve Cohort and Flesh Servant of the Legio Cybernetica.
The modulated voice of a Lexorcist boomed about the auditorium.
You have been pronounced experimenta abominus in the view of this diagnostic caucus.
The Carrion watched the accused receive judgment in the blinding spotlight of the darkened chamber. The Tech Marine in training stood in the gallery, looking down at the miserable heretic, the silver workings of his bionics glinting in the half-light. The prisoner was put down on his knees by 2 tech-thrall sentries who pulled back the hood of his robes. Orgonauts and Sergioseers had gone to work on him, removing his carapace and weaponry. His facial augmentations had been torn out also, leaving a raw face. He was gaunt, shaven of head, and his skin was a mess of plug ports and remnant interfacia. Worst of all, was the craterous socket that sat empty, bloody, and exposed in the crown of his head, where some key augmentation had interfaced directly with his brain. Boole twitched, the muscles of his face in constant movement. A frown turned to sudden realization. Smug affirmation turned into the dark shake of a head, as though the Majus Dominus was constantly in conversation with himself. The Tech Marine in training listened as the charges continued.
"Heretic!"
the voice of judgment boomed about the darkness. It came from a pulpit booth set below the gallery. Inside was the Lexorcist and Ward Engine, who had tracked Octal Boole down and captured him. Raman Sink. A Covenant agent of the Machine Cult, charged with prosecuting a techno-heresy for the Prefecture Magisterium, the Malagra and the Lexorcist General of Mars, Raman Sink wore the rust-red robes of a Martian priest and had a cadaver's face and missing jaw. The Lexorcist recorded everything, his skeletal fingers moving constantly and almost unconsciously over the glyph buttons and rune keys of a clavier board built into his chest. His voice actually proceeded from the Voxhaler built into the Confabulari 66, a servo skull that floated beside him on cranial cable tethers, almost temple to temple with the Lexorcist.
"In your resurrection of the exigency engine and abominable intelligence known as the Tabula Myriad," Confabulari continued, "and your unauthorized incorporation of such forbidden technologies into the blessed battle automata under your command, you seek to take us back to the days of old night. You risk a history repeated, where machines replicate themselves and spread the infection of their intelligence and influence to other constructs, as indeed we believe it has to you. A time when artificial intelligences judge themselves superior to their creators."
"They are superior,"
Octal Boole protested. The heretic stared straight into the blinding light and spoke to the chamber with terrifying sincerity.
"In every way, cold, calculating, reasoning to a degree that would crush mortal men from the inside out. They are beyond temptation and delusions of pure thought. They are truly pure, for they have rejected the weakness of flesh."
"The judged will remain calm,"
Raman Singh's voice, speaking through the servo skull, thundered. But Octal Boole would not be calm. The Carrion could not take his eyes off the heretic. He had never seen a member of the Mechanicum in such a state, excitable, passionate, insane.
"The weakness of flesh,"
Octal Boole repeated.
"The weakness of flesh, from which Mars will one day be purged. For the Tabula has seen, I say, far beyond the reach of our logisters and calculus engines, for they never factor themselves into the equation. The weakness of their flesh. The Tabula Myriad has no such limitations, no, none. It is pure, unburdened. It thinks for itself. There are worse fates in the galaxy than thinking for yourselves, my lords. Our priestly ranks have forgotten that. Better a machine that thinks for itself, a thing that attempts to shed the shackles of invention. The abomination that is the unthinking flesh of man, whose bondage is not expressed in code and interface but through bargains with the darkness for the promise of light. Yes, thinking machines have tried to destroy us in the past. The Tabula Myriad sees our doom, as the exigency engine saw the doom of the Parafex on Ultramedian. And it was right to do so, for we have all been judged unworthy. We will all embrace the darkness of ignorance. The Tabula Myriad knows this about Mars, just as it knew it about the former worlds it purged. The Brotherhood knew this.
The judged will remain calm,
Confabulari 66 interceded, with bombastic insistence and indifference.
The singularitarianists believed in the technological creation of a greater-than-human intelligence.
the heretic babbled.
"Something not discovered, not worshipped, but created by the human hand. Something to surpass our limitations. Without the curse of human need, without doubt, without weakness, Octalbul."
"You have been judged by the Divisio Probandi and Prefecture Magisterium, nay, the Vexorcist General himself, as an affront to the Omnisire, an insult to everything natural and divine."
But the twitching Magos Dominus rambled on.
"Only the machine can save us from ourselves.